Hello and welcome to the Disney Magic Hour, episode number 48. On this week's show, I sit down and interview artist Rob Kaz. It's only me right now, so say hello, Pete, and say hello, Pogo. That was The Trouble. You can find that video and more over at youtube.com/pogo, his music at soundcloud.com/pogomix, and his website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter for this show at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That is at D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, if you search for the Disney Magic Hour, you can find our group and add yourself to it. And if you head on over to iTunes and you give a 5-star review, Melissa will read your review on the air at the end of the show. If you head on over to Google Play Music and get into the podcast area, if you search for Disney Magic Hour, you can find us there as well. And you can download, stream across all your platforms, all of our episodes over at soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. So as I said, I am the only one here right now because I'm pretty much just going to give you guys an intro, and then I want to get you into the interview that I had with Rob Kaz, who does a lot of work for Disney, and you might know him specifically from the piece that he did of Dumbo flying over New Fantasyland. I think it might be a fair assessment to say that's his most popular piece, the one that he could call like a signature piece. So I was lucky enough to get in touch with him. He was very, very cool. You know, we sat down and spoke for almost an hour and a half. And the great thing is that I use the word interview, but that's not really the word to use. I really just had a conversation with the cat. You know, we sat down over at the Sanaa Lounge in Animal Kingdom Lodge. So if you hear some background noise, that's what it is. But it's Animal Kingdom Lodge, so it's always great noise. And we just started talking about everything, not just, you know, hey, what's your favorite Disney film? Like, that's not where it went. Maybe in my brain, that's what I had set up a little bit, just because, you know, you don't know a person. You don't know how great you're going to have a chemistry with them just talking about everything. And so I had a bunch of, I would say, stock questions at the ready, and I didn't have to use any of those almost. If I did, they came up naturally just because we were having a conversation. That's where it led to next. So I'm going to stop talking and just bring you into the conversation I had with Rob Kaz. Enjoy, guys.
I actually did the wedding here, and it was 3 years ago.
Do it at the castle and all that stuff? Or?
We had a photo shoot at the castle.
Okay.
We did do that, but we had the ceremony and everything in Hollywood Studios.
Oh.
Yeah, because they had a building back there called the Prop Room, where they just store crap.
I've heard about it. I haven't seen it.
And it's not going to be there, I guess, anymore soon, because that's going to be where Toy Story Land is, I'm pretty sure. But it was just a bunch of props that were just kind of sitting in there. And we didn't have much of it. We didn't have a budget. Like, we were doing it basically because we weren't going to have a lot of people, and we wanted to do it in Disney. So that was a trade-off. It was like New York, huge wedding. Come down to Florida, have it where we want, small wedding.
Right.
So we didn't have a budget. We didn't need it.
Right.
Because the whole thing was decorated. It was like, oh, what do you want to decorate? It was like, nothing. Like, just bring in some tables and, like, let's go.
Why go to a location if you want to hide the location?
Yeah, so it was good. It was really great. So how long, now, you're Doris's wife?
Yeah.
How long have you guys been married?
Coming up on 5 years.
Oh, yeah?
We met down here. She used to live in L.A., but before that, South Georgia. So if you hear the accent.
Yeah, I can hear the accent.
Yeah, but she's a good PR girl. She helps me. She's probably the key to my success at this point.
I've been seeing that a lot, though, like where it's husband and wife combos and they're working together. I met Karen Hallian, an artist that I know of. Her sister is the one who like handles all of her stuff.
And I think you're right in that, but I don't believe it's by design. I mean, realistically, when I went into this, it was just me, and then I picked up an agent, and then through the metamorphosis of an art career, trying to figure out what it actually means, what that means, because it's different to everybody, I realized I needed help. And she had very good skills in PR. She was an events person at the Gaylord Palms. And she did used to work with Disney, but just part-time to get the passes and all that fun stuff. But, you know, she does her job really well, and I'm very, very, very lucky to be married, and beyond that, her skill set. And so, you know, she's taken on a bigger role. And I think it's really expanded my work. I mean, if you do anything social media with me, that's really my wife. I mean, she'll sit there and interview me and ask me, hey, what do you want to post today? But that's all her.
You know, actually, we kind of have the same thing with my wife. Like, I don't do the Twitter thing very well. I'm kind of awful at it.
It's sports. That's what I do.
Yeah, I don't even do that. I'm just, like, nothing. I just go on there to occasionally see what movies are playing locally. And so whenever we're doing stuff for the show, that's always her. So, and also now with that, you probably feel like you can trust the person that's handling all your stuff. Because that's got to be huge, yeah. So, all right, so let's start all the way back. From childhood, were you into art, or was it something that you grew into, like, later in your teen years?
You know, a lot of this is a surprise to me as much as anybody else. I never really looked at art as a career. I never really looked at it as something that was even a profit-generating idea. Like being crafty was not my thing. It was just something I liked to do. You know, when I was in art as a, we'll just say a kid in school, it was something I was good at, but it was just sort of like an easy class, much like gym was, you know.
Okay.
But I noticed people struggling, but I didn't really get it. Fast forward into, let's say, high school, I started to make models and do things like airplanes, model airplanes, World War II stuff, really loved history, so that kind of spoke to me. My dad is probably the biggest influence in that regard, because all this stuff was laying around. He was very much into building. He built an airplane, a two-place Pitts, which is an aerobatic airplane, which he flew competitively. He built houses. He was a general contractor and did a lot of the work himself. And in his spare time, he would carve wildlife. And, this is in South Jersey. This is near Long Beach Island. And he would sell these carvings to dealers in Hoboken and the Jersey side of New York. In particular, Hoboken was one of his big places. But, you know, a lot of this kind of permeated me, where it was just a norm. It wasn't necessarily something where I was, like, pushed by my dad. Like you see some of these kids that get pushed into sports by their parents and put them in special IMG training facilities and things. For me, there's a paintbrush set over there, you know, and so I would go over and play around. I really just did it because I don't even know. It wasn't like I loved it at the time. It was more like it was just part of me. When I want to represent something, it's easier for me to pick up a pen than to talk.
Okay.
You know, like if we were describing something, I'd be like, well, here, let me show you. That was always been part of my life.
All right.
And I kind of found enjoyment in then representing things more complicated ideas. And what we now know as my fine art is basically the culmination of that thought. But I really credit my dad with the facilitation that kind of fostered into a hobby that then grew into a passion and now is a career.
Well, when was that turn point? Like, when did you know, like, okay, this is more than just the hobby part. Like, this can be something. Was it just getting older and realizing that connection, or was it a specific moment? Can you nail that down?
I really can't.
Okay.
I can tell you when I started oil painting. I can tell you when I went into animation. I can tell you when I started making video games. I could tell you when I made the decision to switch over to fine art, but I can't say with like a definitive thing, here's when I loved doing this. It sort of just organically grew, and more, I almost would describe it as it's easier to see it in hindsight, mm-hmm. but I can't pinpoint it.
Okay.
And I will credit a guy named James Coleman, who's a fellow artist of mine. Which is really cool to say he's a, quote, fellow artist. But he was a Disney background artist for decades, one of their lead guys for a number of years. And I used to go into the Weiland Gallery and look at his work.
Okay.
It was a lot of fun for me. I could not afford them to save my life, but it was fun to look, and the people there were really nice. And I just kind of had a good time perusing. And I thought then, wouldn't it be fun to do my own paintings? So I guess you could say that's the beginning of my fine art motivation.
All right.
But I wouldn't say that's the moment where I'm like, I have to become a fine art painter.
Yeah, no.
I don't really even know when that happened. It was more of a animation was hitting a recession before the big one in 2008, October 2008. And so opportunities were becoming a little more scarce. And I moved into video games for a stability because it's a year-round paycheck. Animation's more project to project. Plus, it's also hard to fund animation in Florida outside of the Disney stuff. People around here don't really know the business model as well as they do in Burbank or Hollywood. When that happened, I was working at Electronic Arts.
I was going to say I saw that.
Yeah,
yeah.
My last project was NCAA 2011, but you know they moved us around a lot. They had a lot of restructuring. You know, it used to be decentralized, so I worked on all the games, and then it became centralized where we had teams, and I was on the NCAA team. But long story short, I saw a lot of people getting laid off, and I didn't want to be one of them. And I thought I was going to be proactive, and it was a great time for me, but not for the economy. And when I made that initial foray into fine art, that was October 2008.
So then where does Disney come into it? Was Disney always there?
No.
And just crept up, or did it come over from working with the background artists?
I never painted a piece of Disney art until I became a Disney fine artist.
Okay.
It was something I knew about vaguely. It was something that I wouldn't say didn't interest me. I just never really put mind to it. I was always a production artist at a studio somewhere. So for me, unless they paid me, I probably wasn't going to pay for them or paint for them. That came into play because when you get to a certain level of fine art, and forgive that sounds really ostentatious, but
that's what they call it, so don't worry about it.
When you know,
it's what it's called.
Yeah. When you know, when you get to that level, you know people who know people, and the art is expected to be good. So I had my art on multiple cruise lines, and it was doing very well. For a few months, I was top dog on Royal Caribbean. And I got my work on Princess and a couple other smaller cruise lines, MSC, those kind of things. But my sales figures were really, really good. And I was selling out of certain editions. And that these are all great things when you're looking at someone as far as investment. And so people talked. I use the word invited by the Disney Fine Art people.
Okay.
Because they had some of their people on those same ships doing the work. And so it was like, hey, who's that guy? You know, that kind of thing. But to keep it in layman's terms, I think invited is probably the best word. But it's not always a sure thing. They invited me to paint a few pieces. And so I painted, I think, 5. And I got word from my my manager at that point to just keep going.
Okay, so kind of like a production artist on a film would be hired, be like, you know what, bring in some stuff.
Right.
Let me see if it matches up with what our overall feel is.
Style, does it match the style guide? Does it meet Disney Consumer Products?
Yeah. So what was your first Disney piece? Do you remember?
It was a Bambi piece.
Okay.
Because, you know, with my personal work, I do a lot of wildlife, kind of animated in nature. Very, I think the word a lot of people use is whimsical, with a lot of character. But
currently with the tadpoles.
Yeah, Well, that's that's sort of a marketing thing. But you know, trying to meet the. I have a lot of people who have children, and my artwork is very. It appeals to people who are young and maybe young at heart. So, putting something in a nursery very much goes with that, and I would say I organically found a niche in the young, you know, the children's market. Inadvertently, really, because it was for me, it was just fun to paint little characters like I had done in animation. And obviously, animation is kind of a kid's thing, but I wasn't making that. I was doing it for fun. I was doing it for me.
I think that's why it works, though. If you did it on purpose, a lot of times people can smell that.
And then it just shows up and eventually and then works against you. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, when people... You can almost tell when someone's painting for money. When they're painting it to meet a price point, it almost breathes out of the painting or the piece of artwork. Like, well, you painted a $500 piece of painting. You know, like, you can see that. And a lot of people don't paint from the heart. And for me, painting is a joy. Like, I get lost in it. And when it's done, I take pride in it. If it turns out the way I want it. Sometimes not so much, but you'll never see those. You know, I get a lot of... Like, I had some students contact me yesterday, and they're like, you know, how do I get in the art industry? And it's like, oh, my God.
It's an unanswerable question, almost.
Sort of. I mean, how do you become a pro baseball player?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you come over from Cuba on a boat, and... excuse me. But, I mean, there's so many paths.
Yeah, no, we tackle the same question. We're on the Film Basement show, and we've had people say, you know, and we've even just like, how does one get into film now?
Right.
And it's unanswerable. Because going to school is no guarantee.
No.
Meeting somebody is no guarantee.
Think about how many students come out every quarter or every year, we'll say. How many of them are working and how many of them are not? You know, like, how many people have film degrees?
Yeah, your analogy to baseball is actually pretty accurate. If you were to really break down the percentages, how many art students graduate every year in the U.S. and how many the next year have a viable career that can support themselves?
And how long does that last?
Exactly, yeah. Like the retention of actually going for that thing.
One of my favorite sayings is it's hard to get in, but it's harder to stay in.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's so very competitive and... The longer you're in, the higher your pay. So if some kid can do it, no offense to any kids out there, but if you could do it for half the cost, then we're out of the game.
Well, that's going on again. We can, you know, parallel this to film. If you are not willing to work an internship for a year for free, just lost 75 to 80% of the chances that you may have.
But it's a catch-22, because if you don't do that internship, you're not actually in the door.
Yep, exactly.
And what I find in art is a lot of people are willing to do something for nothing. It's a very unique industry in that regard. You won't find doctors, you won't find lawyers, you won't find a guy on the street corner selling, you know, whatever, produce. You won't say, here, have an orange today just for, you know, for exposure's sake. You won't find that.
Yeah.
But in art, you'll have people who will do posters and art, and it's very common and acceptable. And I remember reading an article about a gentleman who does very good graphic design. And Sony or someone, some big company, forgive Sony if this isn't them, but they approached him to do a poster as a contest for a boxing match. And it was a big, big match where, you know, millions of dollars were going to the prize and all this stuff, and it was at Vegas and all this thing, and they invited him to do it in the hopes that he would win the contest. And he's like, well, you know, I'm sorry you're in such... And he wrote this great letter. I wish I could remember the details, but he wrote this letter saying, you know, thank you for the opportunity, but, you know, no thanks. You know, like, I'm sorry you're in such a bind that you don't have enough money to pay an artist to make a poster.
Exactly.
That you literally kind of just... crowdsource it and get it made via quote contest, and in the hopes that you'll win and they'll give you a free trip, which is what, like $3,000 at most.
Yeah.
When if the artists of the world would stick together, I don't mean to say unionize, but sort of just understand that what you do is a service that has value. You know, look around the world. How many logos? How many pieces of art? How many murals? How many, you know, just things out there, sculptures, tables, whatever, how much of that has value because of the artistic nature of it? Don't give it away for free. Because if we all kept to that, we would have viable careers, a lot more people.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think if people stuck together in that and said, no, you know what, this internship or whatever you want to call it, you know, like, I'll do this promo work for a couple of months for free.
Right.
I'm not going to do that because you can hire me or you can not hire me.
Right.
And if that went away, a lot more people would probably have paying gigs.
Because
the demand for this art, for the production design, for everything, it's not going to disappear.
It's
just now going to become something, I can't get my way around it. Because so many production companies get away with it now.
Sure.
They just take advantage of kids who don't have bills yet. They get free labor. And then as soon as they start asking for a salary, there's just another crop they can bring in.
as being someone who worked in digital media for entertainment purposes for over a decade.
You lived through EA, so you got a badge of honor for that one.
they treated me fairly well. Long hours, but they paid me for it. California wages in Florida, you can't beat that.
That's good.
We'll just say, take the example of an intern and apply it to a fledgling studio. It's the same thing. There's a big problem in Hollywood right now where effects studios will take a job for nothing in the hopes that it will build their portfolio.
Yep.
But they're beating themselves over, let's say everybody when he works, let's say they come up with Iron Man 4. Everybody's going to be falling over themselves to be part of that because, yeah, ILM might lead it, but they'll have some shots that'll go to Framestore and some that'll go to whoever, MPC if they're still around. DreamWorks might jump in under their banner, whatever. It doesn't matter. You have these small studios that work for no profit, and they're like fly-by-night now. Like, they'll go out of business after one or two pictures because these studios will then expect them to work for nothing. And that's just the industry. And you're seeing them go out of business. Like,
it's like government contracting now. It's the lowest bidder. It's not the highest quality.
It's the lowest bidder, yeah.
There used to be, you know, that saying, actually, Walt Disney said, you know, quality will out. But it's not really true anymore. Yeah. It's basically like budget will out.
Right.
That's the winner in the end of the day nowadays.
When I left the industry, so to speak, it was moving towards a model of having a few key people and outsourcing everything else. And outsourcing even what they did. Like, even at EA, I would create some master art that they would then ship to some Singapore studio where they would create the 100 like it in varying styles. So let's just say mascots. I would do one mascot or five mascots, and they would outsource the other 175 to this studio in Singapore. And they would come back, and I would quality check them, and, you know, usually they checked out, but I'd like to think it would have been better if I would have done it. But
yeah,
hey,
it's not the same. No, that's not an ego, mate. That's just the reality of it. I mean, imitation is still imitation. It is what it is.
But it brought the costs of the studio down. And then they can write off a lot of that. So, from a tax perspective, which is very important as an artist.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, it's a business. They still got to run it as a business. It just comes off as so sleaze, you know. And then they release the same game pretty much. I mean, EA in particular, like, virtually the same game every year with a different year at the end of it.
I will fight you on that to my death, but I
in
know...
In the more recent years.
I have found that in art nowadays, it's perception. It's as far as business goes. It's what people think is the reality, no matter if it's true or not. So, because you think that, it is reality. You play the game, I'm sure you...
I stopped.
Well, there you go.
I was the NHL guy.
I love those.
And they took away features. That was the backbreaker. I mean, did we get less?
if you want to get technical, it comes down to... There's this box you have to fit a game in. And that is the disc. And if you want to make the game play better, you have to add code, you have to add graphics, you have to add features. And features is a buzzword. So let's say they add an expansion team. Like I just heard Las Vegas got an NHL team.
Is that official?
If it's not official, it's probably going to be.
Of no one.
I think they're going to be called the Black Knights.
Why not?
Why not the Aces or the Gamblers or something?
The Black Knights?
Yeah.
Like Monty Python? If they do that, right? Then I'm in.
Yeah. You shall not pass. Yeah. So.
As we sit in Florida with two hockey teams, which is beyond insane.
I was a Devils fan, so.
I was a Rangers fan. Still am. They're terrible.
But to the club.
We're all terrible.
I forget where I was going with all that.
We were talking about features and games fitting boxes.
So let's say you add an NHL team. There's all the colors, the logos, the textures, everything. This is all data that you have to fit in the game. So
absolutely.
If you add that team, you have to take away something that was in the previous game. Like, data-wise. Just think X's, ones and zeros here. That only so much... It's like a Twitter thing. I know you said you weren't really, really mastering Twitter, but Twitter, you have so many characters.
Yeah,
well, if you add... Let's say you have to add a hashtag for Disney. Well, that's D-I-S-N-E-Y. That's six characters plus the hashtag that you cannot fit now you're in your message. So what do, okay. what do you put there? You have to be more...
I understand, but you, we can also go further into that tech yeah. and say, like, don't tell me that the Blu-ray you're using is filled to the brim.
It's really, they cram
and
it.
Then
they,
there oh, are, they cram well, there are triple-layered Blu-rays right now.
Oh, there's meetings about how much data is left.
There's a, who I forget who's... Oh, I know who it is. The first triple data Blu-ray disc is going to be used for the 4K release of Batman vs. Superman on Blu-ray.
Okay, well, let me
That'll
let
be
me
the
say
first
this.
One. If of you're, course, that movie.
Right. If you're a video game studio, right, video game studio, and you're developing a product that actually is not just going to Xbox or PlayStation,
mm-hmm.
you have to basically make the game for the weakness of both platforms.
Yes. Yeah.
So if, let's say, the Blu-ray disc, yeah, it can hold 10 times more than the HD disc or the DVD or whatever, you then have to build the game for the lowest common denominator. Processing, disc, this, that. And so when I'm building a game and I'm porting it, there's this cool program that someone with much more pay than me would have designed a little button that says, you know, make game, and and I export my stuff out, and it parses the files, and it dumbs them down for the different formats. And Xbox, let's say Microsoft and Sony, don't want the other company having an advantage. So they say, if you want to put your disc on our, if you want to put your game on our platform, you can't make Xbox is better than ours. They all have to be equal, or we're not doing it.
I don't know if that exists that much anymore now, because there are we are starting to see games come out where, obviously, resolutions are very different
right.
now. Xbox can't cram out 60 frames a minute, a second,
right.
I mean. And then the PC version comes out, looks better than everything.
Yeah, keep in mind, my information is now 6-7 years old.
Oh, yeah, we got to have a big conversation after this about what's going on.
I'm a finer boy now. Gaming
is going nuts. But anyways, so let's bring it back to the art.
But this is why I like what I do now, is because I don't have to worry about all this.
Yeah, no.
I can become a fan again.
Now, actually, do you get to pick your pieces?
Yeah.
So whatever you want to do.
Whatever I want to do. As long as it's within the license and it doesn't... You know, I don't have Mickey Mouse stabbing someone, you know, like...
Okay.
Yeah, I can do whatever I want within reason.
It's a guideline.
Yeah.
You can follow that.
I mean, there's logical things you're like, yeah, I probably shouldn't do that. Like, you see on some of these fan websites and, like, DeviantArt and
DeviantArt
whatnot...
DeviantArt in particular.
You have, like, slutty princesses and stuff.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that.
No.
And nor would I want to. It would never sell.
Yeah, no. Unless you're Alan Moore, then you release Lost Girls and everyone loses their damn mind.
There's a
niche. But now
for
you
everybody.
Can... Now yeah. you can draw someone stabbing someone because Star Wars.
Yeah, this is true. And
now, did that start when Disney acquired Lucas?
No.
Oh,
no.
That was before
they're still,
that.
They're still very separate. And they
okay.
have their own political strings. And much like, and this is all my opinion based on my interactions, but nothing's really changed other than the owner. So when I deal with Lucasfilm, I'm dealing with Lucasfilm. I'm not
yeah.
dealing with Disney Consumer Products, who controls the Lucasfilm properties. So when I paint a Disney painting, it goes to Disney Consumer Products. When I paint a Star Wars painting, it goes to Lucasfilm. In fact, it goes in front of George himself.
Okay.
He has first right of refusal on every painting, original painting, produced.
But so, not anymore. Would that be Kathleen
Kennedy? No,
he still does.
He still does.
Okay.
Yeah. The contracts that were in place are still in place on
okay.
certain things, at least with me. That being said, anything can change. I don't know what his agenda is. I know he was trying to open a museum in Chicago. I heard from Chicagoans that, forgive me if that's the wrong term, but that's not really happening now.
No, it's not.
They got pissed
and
off. Because
he wanted
of some,
to do it.
It's like a parking lot, and they
yeah.
want to keep it a parking lot.
Chicago. And he wanted to do it also in San Francisco. There was a location, Metallica used it as a studio. A couple of albums ago, I can't remember the name, but he wanted to do it there, and that got nixed also.
Weird.
I feel
come
like
to Orlando. We got plenty of land.
You have, see, you have that, and you kind of have a ranch.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to make something, just bring people there, because I know that the Adventures by Disney, they have that weekend at Lucas, you know, where you stop at LucasArts, but you really don't go very much past, like, hallways and the main... You know, atrium.
Right.
And that's pretty much because everything
it's
is so
like
underlocking.
Imagineering.
Yeah, it's so under lock and key. So I feel like if he would just make something that's maybe a little tied into the brand a little bit more, where he can use Disney to his advantage. But then again,
he's out.
People made comments.
Yeah.
Some people made certain comments about...
I feel for George. As a creative person, I really feel for George because it's his. He made it. It's his baby. You should be able to do what you want. Like, I have a frog named Bo, and he's my central character in my art. If he became so big and then I had a whole fan set telling me what I was doing wrong with him, it would just not be fun anymore. So I totally get why he's what he is.
Well, what about the original cut and the special edition cut?
Yeah.
Now, there's something different. Now, do you think that both should be available to the fans because it was? Or does he have eminent domain, basically? And it's like, no, I say this is what it is, and now this is what it is.
See, you're delving into a question that has more to it now. Like, when it first came out, sure. But now, I mean, I believe Han shot first. Because for me, there's a character arc there where he's a scoundrel who will do anything it takes to make a buck and get out. And then he becomes a hero at the end of the film. And, you know, now obviously we know even more than that. But when you make it so that he was always that way, it just ruins the character arc for me. So I disagree with the decision, but it's his decision to make. So when you ask me that question, I'm conflicted, and I don't have a true answer other than to say it's his baby, he can do what he wants, and we're just along for the ride, fan or not. And
just as a gesture,
right?
Put out the originals.
If it were me, I would give people the option.
I would give people the option too.
But I'm not going to say, if I felt strongly about something as a creative person, I'm going to fight for it. I'm going to sit there in a sweatbox meeting and say, no, damn it, I want this. And I've done that, and ultimately I mostly lose, but you know, everybody knows you're passionate, and you know you have creative differences, and you move on.
Did you ever hear his, actually just going on that, the whole Han shot first, did you ever hear his reasoning for the changing?
Sort of.
It came out recently, and he basically was like, I don't want him to be a murderer. The first thing, I don't want your hero to be a murderer. And then right after that, you meet Princess Leia, and she shoots someone in the head. And then it's like, okay, well, I guess, whatever.
She gets tortured, and nobody talks about it ever again.
Yeah, no.
By her dad.
Yeah, by her dad. The movie's pretty dark.
I mean, if you, and I do this a lot with films now, like, and getting back to the fine art subject, when I painted Seven Dwarfs for the first time,
okay,
I watched it like a man who was trying to be vicariously working on that film. Like, I wanted to get every part right, every background to line up and all this stuff, and what I found was it doesn't. There's so many inconsistencies, background changes, the organ moves, the stairs are different, this and that, and I mean, I'm just kind of making stuff up, but what the gist of it is that there's hundreds and hundreds of people who work on these films, and continuity is a problem. There's usually a continuity supervisor. And, you know, they do, in live action, they have the Polaroids of the actors so that everything lines up, but there's still things that change. And then once you hit the editing room, they might move things out of sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 7, for example, when he slams his helmet down when he's interrogating Rey, that was not from that scene. That was from a previous scene, and those ashes are God knows what.
I know they said what that is.
Is it some, like, dead person?
He collects the ashes of the people he kills.
Oh, that's so morbid.
Yeah, I think it's in the book. I think they explained that in the book. J.J. Abrams said it in an interview.
Because
someone asked, they were like, what's with the ashes? And they were like, oh, he's like, oh, that's the people, he collects the ashes of people he killed. It's like, Jesus, man.
Yeah.
Like, you've got some whimsical stuff in here, but...
I mean, what I'm trying to say is, when you look at a piece of art, when you look at a movie, when you look at anything in life, just enjoy it. Don't pick apart the negatives. Don't sit there and try to... It's not a reality show, and even those are fake nowadays. It's
more so than the fiction ones.
Yeah, exactly. Coming from South Jersey, I have a definite opinion about reality shows.
Yeah, I can imagine.
They all from New York, by the way.
Yeah.
Long Island.
Long Island?
Long Island.
That's where we're from.
God help you.
Have I lost the accent yet?
You're getting there.
My Brooklyn one still kicks in when I yell.
Yeah.
Yeah, that comes out. My wife evidently pointed that out to me. But yeah, I agree with you. Everything is a fiction nowadays.
Nothing is perfection.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to be... I mean, if you stare at something long enough, you'll notice something out of place. I take it for what it is, but, you know, I'm a fan. And so some things happen, and I'm like, oh, I don't like that, you know? And I'm honestly, I'm trying to avoid the new series stuff. I ruined myself doing episode 7 because I got images ahead of time that I'm painting from that. Ooh. I'm like, it ruined the movie for me.
Yeah, that would kind of
suck. Horribly ruin the movie for me. So
Rogue One, what was an image in particular? Like, did you see some specific images, like a Han image that you were like, oh...
No, I mean, I didn't see the death scene, but knowing what I knew from interviews that he wanted to die, he thought his character should die previously, I suspected it. And there were images I saw that were like, yeah, I think he probably bought it in that area because it's too dramatic.
I actually thought the production art gave it away because this is just a thing that my brain looks at. I was like, oh, I know all three of the originals, the big three are in here. He's the only one on the poster.
Exactly.
And it's because he's saying goodbye.
You know, and I'll be honest, I thought when Rey was crying over Finn, I thought that was Han.
I thought that too. And then, yeah, I originally just thought that was going to be Han. I also did think, though, that he was going to go out with Chewie.
Okay.
And it didn't go that way, but then that image of Rey and Chewie in the Falcon, I was like, oh, that works.
Yeah.
That really works. Like, I'm totally okay
with
this.
See, I never suspected Chewie, R2, C-3PO, any of those people would go because they're non-human characters that can live forever. You know, what's the lifespan of a Wookiee?
Well, they killed him in the comics. That's why I thought maybe they would take that. That
but
was the only reason
canon
why.
That's not canon now, right?
No, it's totally out the window.
Yeah.
The only thing that's in the window now is the films.
Right.
The new comics and a couple of new novels. Bloodline, I think, just came out. We're supposed to flesh that out a lot.
And I've done a few shows since the whole canon breakdown happened, and I found a lot of fans are really upset because they have characters they love.
Yeah.
And they don't like the fact that they are no longer canon. I mean, adamant fans. And I'm not just talking about the 501st guys that walk around and do that, but I'm talking about people who read the books more than anything. That's their favorite thing on the planet.
But I'll have something to say to those fans, and this is like my reassurance. Number one, no one took the books from you. You can still read them. And so that's okay. Like, they're still there. They didn't, you know, go full Germany on them and burn all the books. You can find them. You can read them. To make new films and to create new stuff with so many shackles already in place...
Yep.
I think it's really, really difficult.
Well, that's just
because
it.
Then the new films, you would already know them.
Right.
They're on bookshelves. Have a nice day.
Well,
so who, you know, it kills a lot of the excitement for
right.
it.
And I think that's. I don't know if you read the interview with J.J. Abrams. He didn't want to do Star Wars because he felt shackled, to use your word. And when they told him, when they asked him the question of like, well, who is Luke Skywalker? He realized. I think in his own words, that basically he could invent the future and not be shackled by canon.
Yeah.
Which
is what he did in a very roundabout way in Star Trek.
Right.
You know, he spent an entire film.
Parallel universe.
Yeah, which then people were upset, but it's like, no, the other story still happened. It's Earth 1 and
universe.
Earth 2. Like, if you read DC, you would know this, and you would think it's insane.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it's just a parallel universe. We didn't kill your Kirk or anything like that.
And on a side note, it tore me up to hear the kid that played Chekhov died.
Anton Yelch, yeah.
And then the nature of his...
Because of the car... Just, a car... what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, it was a shifter on a Jeep.
It was tough to tell if it was in drive or park.
Right. It was under voluntary recall.
Yeah, but
it just tore me up.
What a stupid, awful way.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, look, the world is full of awful, stupid ways, and, you know, things are awful happen every day. But he's 27 years old.
I know.
And he didn't do anything wrong. Like, he wasn't drunk or he wasn't, you know, anything, and that's what happened.
Like, you hope this happens to other people in the media.
Yeah, exactly.
I won't name names, Kanye, but we hope these things happen to them. That's life. But unfortunately, it kind of tore me up. And then, obviously, in Orlando, we've had a tough time recently with not only things that you know, the nightclub thing, but also the Gator thing, which, if you're a Floridian, Gators are everywhere. You can't keep them out of anything. My dad, who lives nowhere near the water, I mean, like, miles from the water, had a gator in his backyard. They migrate.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, you can't do anything
and
about
then
it, unfortunately.
We see people feeding them all the time, and it just makes it worse.
Yeah, that was our drive down, basically. Our drive down was the
the girl from The Voice who was shot.
Oh yeah, I don't remember her name. I didn't see the show. But...
I never really watched the show. And then there was the shooting. And then I believe the next day or the day after was the whole alligator bit. And I was like, wow, all right, welcome to.
I remember my dad texted me like 11 o'clock at night, and it just kind of was like, wow, that's terrible.
Yeah. You know?
But it's a force of nature.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I'm not saying there's nothing you can do about it, but it's sort of like going to the beach and getting a shark bite. The beach can be pristine, they can have lifeguards everywhere, but the sharks are still going to bite.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, the most outrage that you hear, which it's the internet, you're going to hear outrage about anything, was that there's no specific signs that say, and if you're not from the area, like for you, what you just said, like there are gators everywhere. Like it's just a given. A lot of people probably won't make that because they also come and they're in the Disney bubble and nothing can happen in the Disney bubble.
Right.
I agree that a certain amount of common sense thinking of your surroundings have to come into play. But I also agree that I know they didn't put up the signs because that's a bad sign to see on Disney property.
Right.
Like, no one wants to see that.
Well, let me make just a interject a point here.
No, please.
Do they need to now put up signs that say there might be harmful bacteria in that water?
Exactly.
Do they need to put up signs that say there are snakes in that water? Do they need to put up signs that...
They did, actually. That, it's part of the gator sign.
Okay.
Yeah.
I give them credit for that. Do they need to put up signs that within 10 miles there's a sexual predator living north of Disney? I mean, do they have to do all these things?
I saw a thing that was going around. It was like a woman bought a house in wherever the hell she bought a house. She was attacked by a mountain lion. And it's...
Oh, with a kid, yeah.
Can you blame the previous owner because they didn't tell them, like, hey, there's mountain lions who live here?
Yeah.
You know, it's a very sketchy in the middle. So I think Disney's handling it well.
And this,
I think they're handling it well.
This is actually interesting to me because I was a criminal justice major in college.
Okay.
Fine art was my fun thing. But I find these kinds of things fascinating and interesting, and I really feel for the loss for the... I mean, I can't imagine. Like, I only have two dogs, but if one of them was taken by a gator, I would be inconsolable. So then take that to, like, 100 times that and a child.
Yeah. And when you're on vacation, a place you love visiting, it's like, oh, God, I can never come here again.
I have some friends that come down, and they're worried about snakes and things like that, but... All these stories are coming out now of gators, and they're like, see, it's a dangerous thing. And I'm like, but it really isn't if you just exercise common sense. But for, like you said, some of these people, that, you know, if they're coming from Europe or whatever where they don't have alligators, it's not entering their brain.
Yeah.
It's a beach.
It's just a beach. Oh. Just a beach.
And you know, when you're watching a fireworks show or whatever was happening at that time, they can be distracted. And I've you know, going back... The gorilla story with the child fell in the exhibit,
a couple of
that
weeks
kind
back,
of thing,
yeah.
Where it was like one second he's standing there, the next minute he's in the exhibit. These, you know, obviously children are by nature a little bit unwieldy, and I just think that it's Disney said, don't go in the water. You don't go in the water, and
especially that water because it's kind of
nasty.
Disgusting.
It's really nasty.
It's really
like if I saw my kid in that water, I'd be like, "Get the hell out of there!"
Can I get you another beer?
Can I have a water?
Water,
thanks.
I remember there were some people who swam from Contemporary to Discovery Island.
Oh yeah, I saw the pictures.
You know, and they put up the pictures and stuff. And my first thought was,
"It's like Jurassic Park."
You made it. Like that was my first thought was you swam through that water and didn't. But still, I was like, how did you not get nicked by an animal?
Well, that's
was
just,
really
that's
my
just
thought.
It is so rare.
Yeah.
Like, I'll give you my first and only true full alligator experience.
I hope I never get to tell this story like you do, but go ahead.
I had just moved here. I was like 18 years old. Celebration, Florida, just outside of Disney, just opened. Literally, there was nobody living there. And I was a... I was a skater that I would go around... And in the middle of the night, I worked late, I was an insomniac, all the factors were there for me to be up at 2 a.m. skating around an empty town. I jumped their front steps, which is like a 10-foot jump, but 20 feet long, and I landed at the bottom, and I sort of spilled and landed. I look up, and there is this massive alligator. He probably wasn't that big, but to me, he was in my face, like across the table, kind of close. And I think I scared him more than he scared me because he took off like the fastest thing I've ever seen. So I will just say that my experience with gators is that they are more scared of you than you are of them.
Yeah, but
it
if
only
they see
changes
something.
When people feed them. Yep. And people treat them like, oh, how cute.
Yeah.
You know, you don't go up and feed a lion in Africa. They will associate you with food.
Yeah.
You don't sit there as a person with any kind of intelligence and say, you know, I'm in a strange place, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. You have to be mindful. I feel terrible for these people, but at the same time, if I go to Africa, I'm not going to go wandering in a water hole.
Yeah.
It just, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, just watching, keep the kids away from everything. I don't know. You got to watch this movie, Roar. It's an insane film with Tippi Hedren and her husband at the time, who I can't remember. It's, they used to live with lions. They would just live with, like, a pride of lions.
Okay.
So this movie is, it's supposed to be like a pro-nature, you know, but
the bear guy?
Oh, I love that documentary, Grizzly Man. There are 30 lions just roaming around. A couple of panthers, a couple of tigers.
Why not?
And they're all just, they're not trained. And they're all just mixed in together in the same house. It's a madhouse. It's phenomenal. Actually, you know, in Grizzly Man, when I actually first saw that in the theater, which whoever's listening, Grizzly Man was a documentary about this guy, Timothy Treadwell, who used to document and interact with bears. And things go exactly the way you would think. Yeah, it goes exactly the way you would think. The movie used to open with a scene from Letterman. He was on Letterman, and Letterman jokingly says, are you one of these guys that we're going to find out in a couple of years gets eaten by a bear? And the whole audience laughs, and Treadwell kind of like nervously laughs. And then when that movie came out on DVD and stuff, they cut that out because Letterman said, I would have never meant that. Like, I feel terrible that, like, that's there. I would have never thought that. Can you please take it out? And they took it out.
Yeah.
Because Werner Herzog probably said something awesome in his accent, and he's like, yes, I'd take it out. So, we really went all over the map on that one. So.
Yeah, this conversation is meandering, but.
It's good.
It's fun.
It's fine. What. Do you have, like, a favorite thing that you're drawing right now? Like, between, like, Star Wars and your Disney license, you know?
People ask me this. The only thing I can say is it's like listening to music.
Okay.
You're in the mood for things. You might turn on some classical, rock, whatever, rap, you know. Personally, it could be movie scores all the way to, you know, what's trending on the Billboard Top 100. I mean, it really is all over the map. And I do movies, too. But much like that, art, creativity, you kind of find inspirations of a sort. I don't like to use the word inspiration for how I do art. For me, all the inspiration I need is walking into, sitting in front of the easel and starting. I don't need to go and be inspired, you know, like some of these people you hear that they've got the beret and the mustache twirl.
I went to film school with a lot of them.
And not to put any of them down, and I'll give you an example. Like, when I worked at EA, there were guys, like, and I'll put myself in this category, that would show up early, stay late, just churn all day long. We'd grind, we'd put out a lot of art. But then there'd be people who took two-hour lunch breaks and would show up at 10 o'clock and leave at 4 o'clock, but they would get the same amount of work done. It was just that their workflow was different.
Yeah.
And art studios really put up with the different styles because there's different kinds of artists, and I just happen to be the kind of guy that works a lot and shows up and doesn't do drugs and... short of a beer, I'm pretty clean.
How do you know when something is done? Do you ever?
Or
do you just at a certain point, you're like, okay, this, you know, I gotta step away?
Complicated question.
Yeah, I saw this in on your Facebook. Like, you kind of referenced it a little bit, so I was like, oh, I gotta ask this.
The official answer is when the signature goes on. The non-official answer is that I really have a hard time walking away from anything. And, you know, to do this as a profession, you cannot dwell on something too long. And ultimately, I tend to walk away from a painting when I feel like I'm not making it better.
Okay.
When I'm just making it different. So, the idea is that you want to keep working on something as long as you're making it better. And for me, I'd like to think that I can identify that pretty quickly. And, you know, different strokes for different folks, no pun intended. It's just sometimes when I think I'm nowhere near to being done, someone walks up and says, I'll buy it. And I'm like, but I'm not even done. And they're like, don't touch it. I love it. I'm like, no.
Have you ever had one where what was the hardest one where you just couldn't figure out the finish line?
I don't know if I have a specific one. I'd be remiss to think of a specific example. I'll reference those first five Disney paintings.
Okay.
I had, I think, 2 weeks to do five paintings, which is aggressive.
Two weeks to do five full paintings?
Yeah.
What size are we talking about?
A couple of them were 30 by 40, so fairly
large.
Oh,
my God. Okay.
I'd like to think I'm a fast painter, but I'm an old painter, so there's limitations. Like, there's a few drying hours that have to go into a painting before you deliver it, otherwise it'll be wet. But I can handle that. I can handle deadline pressure. Like, I have a show coming up July 1st through the 3rd at that Wyland Gallery I referenced earlier, and they want three paintings.
Okay.
I just found that yesterday.
The Wyland one in Boardwalk?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Great.
They're a big Disney show. Lots of Disney fine artists. And I'm okay with that. It's not that I love it. Obviously, I'd want more time. But when it comes down to it, it's my profession to be able to create on demand with authority. You know, like to say, can you do three paintings in... Really, I have 11 days, but because of the drying constraints and varnishing and all that, I probably have a week.
Okay.
I can do that. And it's just efficiency, where a Rob from 10 years ago might take a month or 3 months to do a piece because I don't know how to achieve a certain result. Nowadays, I've trained myself so that I can effectively make every brush stroke the way I want it the first time. And if you look at my work, there's not a lot of thickness to the paint because I'm not overpainting things. I'm not going over 100 times to get Ariel's face just right. I'm doing it either the first or the second time with authority and getting it done, moving on to the background or whatever, or vice versa. So I will say that I have the confidence now because of so many years of practice and experience and dealing with deadlines and pressure that it doesn't bother me anymore. It's more like just getting the job done. Something, like I said, I don't need inspiration.
Yeah.
I just sit down and do it.
Something that I really, really like about your art is I'm a big fan of concept art.
Yeah, me too.
Because I can see the work. Like, it's all there. So, like, whenever we do a Disney movie review, I go back and I find concept art, and I'll put that as the banner image and whatnot. Your art has that feel to me.
Thank you.
Where, like, I can see the work still. Even though it's a finished product, I can see the work. And it, like you were saying before, it has a playfulness to it.
Right.
That I also think you find in concept art.
Right.
So it's one of my it's one of the things I really, really admire about your art, actually, is that kind of feel.
It is a tough
feel.
Line to walk, though.
Yeah.
Because
are you worried about looking too sketchy occasionally?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, my propensity is to move away from that. And I've tried to almost teach myself that there's a way of being effective with visual art. And each person's different. And I always go back to the comparison of Ivan Earle. And forgive me for comparing myself to Ivan Earle. That is just a step that I even, when I'm saying it, I'm like, shut up, Rob. But it's true. It's when you look at his works, and I've seen his originals at the ARL, they are so very detailed. Every inch of the painting is so articulate. And it's beautiful. It's not the way I would do it, but that's what makes us different. And like I said, forgive the comparison. And I've read that if you ever get a chance, YouTube, Three Men Paint a Tree or Four Men Paint a Tree or something like that, and it's Ivan Earle and a couple other Disney artists out there painting one tree. And every one of them is amazingly different.
Oh, that's
and I think
great.
Walt narrates the thing, and it's really great. But Ivan has a style that the viewer is the lens.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're looking, that's where the subject is. So he doesn't know... He wants to create an environment that you could be anywhere in it, as long as you're looking at it. And your eye creates the composition. I see the logic in that. I just am more of a person who wants to give you a presentation of art. And so I try to guide you via detail, contrast, color use, lighting, really in general, and create a scene for you so that you know where to look by design.
Okay, I got you.
So the fringes of the painting will be a little bit less detailed, a little bit more, we'll just say blocked, for lack of a better word. You know, I want you to feel like you're looking through a multi-plane camera, and the stuff in the foreground is not what you're looking at. I want you to see the cottage in the distance with the seven dwarves coming out of it. I want you to look at my frog, and the leaves in the foreground and the background are out of focus by design. That whole depth of field,
yeah.
To use a technical...
Which I love when they did that in WALL-E in particular.
Sure.
I thought it was brilliantly used.
Because it puts the viewer in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that... And I'm not being critical of Ivan's style. It's just that my style, this is what I find most effective for me. Because when I saw those James Coleman paintings at the Wieland Gallery so many years ago and put them on the wall, I wanted to be in... I have a whole series of landscape paintings I call Places I'd Rather Be, and that's... I use that term because that's literally what I'm thinking when I'm putting them. I'd rather be there. And nowadays, I live in a nice area, but back in the day, I was working in a bar, you know, lifting kegs of beer, and I was making decent money, but I didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And so I tried to paint places I'd rather be. And then the frog came about because I was a character artist and I wanted to do that. But in a lot of ways, I want someone who views my work to feel like they're in the work, that they could get lost in it and not so much become a director and you know, not to criticize again Ivan, I love his work, but my style is more of a presentation style.
But I think you have a little more director in you than you may realize, actually, because the way that you're describing the way you want to frame things is a very director, directory type of thing.
I was an art director at one point, but that means something different than like a film director.
Yeah.
You know, you're creating, you are overseeing the style of a film and not so much the direction, the scene setups, that kind of thing. And I did scene setup too, but the director is someone who the buck stops there. Well, the financiers, but
nowadays it's a producer, but yeah, on
depending
the set
on who you're talking about
on the set.
Yeah.
On the set, you know, yeah, it depends on the relationship between him and the cinematographer.
Sure.
Because when I was ever, you know, whenever I do a film, I storyboard. I'll usually storyboard, and then I'll work with the cinematographer and say, okay, what's dumb, and let's figure out, you know, your suggestions, because that's why I brought, you know, I want to work with you.
Right.
And then for that, you'll find like the language of the film.
Right.
You know, which is kind of the way you have to do it. But now you're your own cinematographer, you're your own director.
Exactly.
You know,
I mean,
you're the focal lens, you're everything.
I'm using the sandbox that is Star Wars and Disney and my own personal works.
What a sandbox to play in, right? That's great.
It is. It's sincerely what it is.
You're sitting there
and you're digging around and you find something, and like Legos, you know, you're making your own scenes.
Yeah.
And you know, for someone who out there who might be listening who does not really have a propensity for visual arts, at a certain point for me it just clicked that I could do whatever I wanted, like not in the sense of I was permission to do it, but rather that I had the ability.
Mm-hmm.
And visual and digital arts really is where that happened, where I realized I could make anything in the computer in 3D and animate it. I have that ability even today for fun, and some of the, like, if I don't know angles, like, I'll give you an example. Episode 7 is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that scene where the the X-Wings are coming in low and...
On the water, yeah.
On the water. That was the only shot I had to go on of what those X-Wings looked like. And I was having people ask me to paint them, but from a different angle. So I'm sitting here going, well, how the heck do I know the angles, the sight lines of these new ships? I'm not really familiar with them. Let me just go home to mama. I went into a program called Maya. I built the X-Wing from the screen reference, and I could then move it around and light it and do whatever I wanted to create my own reference to see how the lines lined up. And it took me a little while, but ultimately it enabled me to be able to see a new shot that didn't exist, and I painted that. And I still did that to this day. I mean, I just built a Millennium Falcon so I could make some cool, like I could play around like a kid with Legos or Matchbox cars or whatever and create my own scenes as a director, much like you would storyboarding or beatboarding or what they call animatics now.
Animatics is great,
To sort of create my own little shots. And for someone who really loves Disney, who really loves Star Wars, and has a passion for creating new products like my Bow series, being able to go through the process of creation and making a new shot for Star Wars or a new scene for Disney, even though they don't really, really love that. you know, plausible is a word I'll use when it comes to like certain things where could this have happened?
Yeah, okay.
That will get through, but you know you can't go crazy. The Lucasfilm absolutely loves when you're creative, and they encourage you to go off and have fun with it. Like, I hate that term, but
I wonder how much fun they would let you have with Ahsoka right now. I'm really curious.
I've had a lot of people, but for the common fan, they don't even know who that is.
No, they don't, but...
And I have to bridge
they
that.
They should, though. I think that's...
See, I'm a fan of the Old Republic. I want them to make that film more than anything.
I want them to make that more than I want to see a Han Solo film.
When I have a conversation with someone who might be collecting my work, and if I start talking about the Old Republic and the Ebon Hawk, and they look at me like I have four heads.
Yeah.
But for me, I'm a fan. So.
Yeah, I think that that's coming. I do. I honestly think that's coming.
Back that up. Tell me how you know that.
Because they have totally open ground to work with now. Okay. There's literally no...
Finding stories like Rogue One that
there's
plausibly
zero,
happen.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I kind of think some familiar faces from an animated show might pop in.
Well, they're doing that with the Rebels series. They're bringing the Clone Wars...
I think Rebels is the show that you might see someone walking in the background or something.
All right.
Maybe a familiar ship, maybe a familiar shape. They did say that Vader is going to be in Rogue One.
I heard that today.
So...
Along with a new TIE fighter, new AT-AT.
Great, go for it.
I'm really trying to avoid this, but Facebook is a horrible place to avoid rumors.
Well, you know what's lucky is they're reshooting so much of the dialogue that only so much can get leaked now, but I'm totally okay with it.
All I can say is that trailer gave me chills, and if it's anything like that, ship it.
I want a different visual, I want a different tone, and that's exactly what that trailer was.
One of my favorite things about Star Wars is... Return of the Jedi. I'm sorry, Empire Strikes Back.
I was about to flip the table.
Slap myself. Where there was a dark feel. Like, A New Hope had a little bit of it, but there was that sort of wonky, cutesy, every now and again thing. And they almost put that same thing in Empire Strikes Back with the whole the Echo Base and the what's that? The big white monster. Oh,
Wampa?
The Wampa, yeah, okay. Sorry. Brain fart. They had a whole deleted scene where the Wampa runs loose in Echo Base.
Yeah.
Which was so Christmas specially.
Yeah, that would
have
been weird.
You didn't want to go there. But if just look it up on YouTube, it's out there. I'm so glad they cut it. But aside from that, I really loved that it was a human interest story. It was a romantic story ending in tragedy. And I hope they revisit some of that grit. Because to me, the Star Wars universe is a dirty, used, very dangerous Western-type film. And in Westerns, tragedy strikes, things happen. There's a lot of, you know, the sandstorm feel with the tumbleweeds and the lone stranger who comes into town. That kind of a thing.
But I also think that it's an incredibly healthy balance, because as much threat and real threat lies in Empire Strikes Back, the best humor also came out of the, you know, with the Han Leia go back and forth, really exclusively with them, almost. You know, Yoda's got some lines when he's not being Yoda, when he's being just the folksy, you know, guy. But I think that that's such a hard tone to find. Force Awakens did a decent job of trying to mimic some of it.
It I think they did a good job. So I give them credit.
Yeah, very high bar. But I think that's the hardest. That's the great thing about Empire is everyone's really in trouble, but we're not drubbed with the dark thing. The way that we can say, and everyone who's a Film Basement listener drink, Batman vs. Superman does. You know, like the DC films so far, they're just the dark without any sort of, you know, light at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
And if the light does show up, it shows up literally in the last 3 minutes, and then that's it.
But there's so much tragedy along the way.
There is. There's so much to get there.
Well, I think that's where the Marvel film actually excels, is, yeah, there's tragedy, but it's healthy balance.
Yeah, it's a healthier balance than what you get on the other one.
Yeah.
But my knock on Marvel films is what I'm hoping we get right with this Rogue One. Every Marvel film looks aesthetically the same. There hasn't been a single film that I can't look at and go, oh, that's blah, blah, blah. Like, but they're all the same.
As a person who worked in film, don't you want that? Don't you want that overriding, it's the same universe feel?
No, because I don't... It's the same
universe. You've seen Ant-Man, though. That is completely different.
Not visually, though. The color temperature and everything is all the same. Now, if you would have put Edgar Wright behind that film, then that film would have looked a lot different. And the reason
he wanted to make it darker.
Yes, he wanted to make it a little darker, but also I think that there would have been a lot of Scott Pilgrim-y kind of camera looks in there.
Okay.
And that's why he ultimately didn't get the finalization on that job. So what I see, though, is the Avengers films visually should look the same, because those are the same films.
Okay.
But when we're talking about other films, let them experiment a little bit more with look and with camera use and everything, because you can argue it's kind of standard. They don't take a lot of risks. But if if you're a comic book fan, the Hawkeye comic looks nothing like the Avengers comic.
And
you know,
thankfully.
And that's a thing. But then when Hawkeye is in an Avengers thing, you're not thrown off. You're like, all right, now he's in here.
Yeah.
So I think that same kind of flexibility can be given as it's given to the artists in Marvel, give it to the artist behind the camera. And I thought that Ant-Man was the film that could do that, because it was so different. And I also thought Doctor Strange could do that. But you know what? They are trying some things over there. Well, you know, from that trailer, there's a couple of different, this camera's moving a little differently. So maybe they're going to, loosen that. But now Rogue One, I feel, looks very, has a different feel utterly.
See, I disagree. I think it reminds me of Hoth.
Okay.
The shots I've seen.
Okay.
It feels like when they had Mon Mothma talking, like I would swear that was the other actress.
I had so many people try to tell me. Yeah, she's really great. She's really great.
Let me pull this back to my universe right now with fine art.
Yes.
Don't you want, when someone sees your work, to say, that's a Rob Kaz?
Absolutely. But I don't want Rob Kaz to look like Kevin blah blah blah. I want it to look like Rob Kaz.
Right.
So when
you're saying all the Marvel ones look the same.
But then that's when I see an Edgar Wright film, or if I see whoever, like, they really haven't brought in a big name director that I was like, holy crap, guy's doing one?
I thought Favreau was the best one they've done so far.
Yes, I think Favreau is phenomenal. But like, Favreau also is a guy whom I don't know if I could pick out his visual style if you put a bunch of films in front of him.
Okay.
Spielberg, I can. Edgar Wright, I can.
Spielberg would be great.
You know, like, that's the thing. But, like, if they went and they got Spielberg to do a film, which, look, he's doing work with Disney a lot right now. BFG is coming out. Don't be surprised.
I would not be
surprised
if there was a spin-off Star Wars film that he directed.
Obi-Wan,
I would love to
see that. I want Obi-Wan between 3 and 4.
Like a Star Wars World War II-esque film.
I actually want, like, a spy film with Obi-Wan between 3 and 4.
Okay.
Because what happens in there? Does he just sit on Tatooine the whole time?
Right.
Ewan McGregor is the perfect age. Exactly. Ewan McGregor is the perfect age. maybe Jimmy Smith visits him and says, like, I need you.
Yeah.
Like, we have this thing that you have to do. And maybe, I mean, unfortunately, they already brought him into Rebels, but I always thought that him and Maul deserved more.
See, I wanted to see him do, like, a Boba Fett kind of thing.
Fine.
Like,
I'll get behind it. If you, like, put Spielberg behind a camera, great.
Like a Road Warrior-style Boba Fett film, you know.
And you want Spielberg to do that?
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice for that type of film.
I just think he would be, like... And I go back to that scene from the Close Encounters.
Okay.
Where they're discovering something in the middle of the desert, and there's this huge sandstorm. And I go to Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, probably one of my favorite films of all time. And that...
Recently won our favorite film on Film Basement.
God bless it. There's a visual style that when you create an environment of it's almost like mystery, but like the way Alien is with space, the way Blade Runner is with the future, I think Spielberg could do that environment so well to make Boba Fett into something really amazing as a character without speaking, like a spaghetti western kind of thing.
That or full noir. It could go noir with him. Because also, I think Boba Fett's... I'm not a fan. He doesn't do anything in the films. He only became interesting when we started coming up with other things that
this
he
is
did.
True. This is
you know,
true.
But in the films, largely
but
ineffective.
I will give him credit, though. He is crafty MF-er. He can go and figure out what Han's going to do.
Absolutely.
And follow him to Bespin.
Absolutely.
And he's the only reason that film, that the Empire was even half-witted.
And then they didn't capitalize on that in Jedi.
Well, that's not his fault.
Oh, no, it's not. I'm not blaming Boba. But that's what I want to see now. If they're going to do a Boba, because I feel like they are going to do a Boba Fett film.
Right.
If you're going to do it, you've got to make it not feel like the other films. Like you're saying, like, bring in a different temperature.
Right.
And that's what I agree with you. It reminds me of Hoth. But it's also taking, like, different perspectives. Like, a ground shot looking up at an AT-AT. That's great. Much like when we saw a dogfight from land in Episode 7.
Mm.
It was like, oh, we're not in space. Like, we got our TIE fighter fight, but we're on the ground. I thought that was a really great way of taking something familiar
also
and giving it that little twist.
Base was,
same kind of thing, you know? I know they got a lot of heat thrown on them, like, oh, you just remade New Hope, which I totally disagree with.
Well, I'll just point out that I would not have done it. JJ, bless his heart, he had a big, tall mountain that he had to climb.
Yeah.
And there's a, like you said, a balance where if he made it completely new, people would have been like, there wasn't enough old tie-ins.
Yep.
And if he made it just like the old one, people would have complained that they did nothing new. And so he struck a healthy balance, and he's getting criticized for not going too far and not going far enough.
I don't think that was his job, though. Like, yeah. I think I'm with you on this. I think we're going to agree on this. His job was to get us back to safety.
Sure.
Because that series fell off a cliff.
100%. He's there to set up the continuation.
And now the next film, that's where you're going to get chances.
Sure. You're going to see an Empire Strikes Back.
And I'm blanking on the director's name. I always do this. He directed Looper.
Isn't it a Jurassic Park, the Jurassic World guy?
No, he's the one who's doing Colin Trevorrow is doing episode 7, 8, 9.
Oh, okay.
Episode 8 is... Oh my God, Rian Johnson, who directed Looper, and he also directed a number of the key Breaking Bad episodes.
Oh.
So he's the one, and Brick, he also did it.
So a guy good with dialogue.
Guy who has his own kind of view on sci-fi, and can bring a darkness but still have it not feel drubbing like Looper.
Right.
That would be the perfect example.
I prefer the Ivan Kershner kind of guy who is small film-minded.
Yeah.
With a big budget.
Yep, that's Rian Johnson.
I prefer that.
I think you're going to dig. I'm a little nervous about Trevorrow.
Because those kind of directors are, you know, like they're the antithesis of Michael Bay, where it's explosions first, talking second.
Yeah.
Maybe third. you have a person who is used to creating moments, dialogue, creating human interest story, that encapsulates us, brings us in, and then we're in this universe. Like, Anna Leia, Empire Strikes Back, it was a love story.
Yeah.
You know, like, to me, that was a very character arc film that I absolutely loved.
It's still the best one.
Yeah, that's where, like I said, Han Solo is probably one of my favorite Star Wars characters, if not the favorite character, because of his arc. And that film, he went from, like, you know, hitting on Leia, being a real scoundrel, to basically saying, you know, I'll be okay, go on without me.
Doing the sacrifice.
Sacrificing himself. And do I think he should have died in that film? No, but I could see how potent that would have been if in that scene, you know, maybe they gave him the option and he did it anyway to save their lives and sacrificed himself, and ultimately the carbonite chamber killed him. That would have been so impactful as a fan.
Or if that's the way Jedi would have opened.
Yeah.
But what if Jedi would have opened with that?
Something like that.
That would have been even more, like, straight from the start, you got a gut
punch.
I'm a
real sucker for moments in film where there's self-sacrifice for the greater good.
The greater
good. It really pulls my heartstrings. And a lot of war films do that, you know, like Saving Private Ryan and whatnot.
Yeah, Earn This.
Earn This, yeah. So, with Star Wars, those films are... That kind of moment in those films is it's not PG-13. These, I mean, we're having kids watch these films now. You can't have too much of that. So
yeah.
I'm hoping they do, because ultimately this is life, and that's good filmmaking, that's good storytelling, and ultimately it connects with the viewer. Like, I'll admit, you know, I cry sometimes at those moments, and I want to do that in a Star Wars film. Some of the Marvel films have that.
Yeah.
Self-sacrifice, and I love
that. Yeah, Iron Man has done that a number of times, and Cap is pretty much the stalwart, and I think that's going to become a major thing in the later films.
Yeah.
I think Cap is going to really do the sacrifice. Also because certain people have only so many movies left on their contract, and other people have a lot
more.
Yeah.
We'll
see. We'll see how that goes.
Robert Downey Jr. would be the guy if anybody would pick. He says he wants to be part of it, but I think he's at the point now where he doesn't need to. Not compelling as an actor anymore.
I think Bucky's taking that shield eventually.
I think you're probably right. Sebastian Stan is a really good version of Captain America, but at the same time, I want to be surprised.
How nuts has it been that Chris Evans has become, like, so perfect as Cap?
Yeah.
You know, and rebounding from being in a poor superhero film. Like,
Fantastic Four.
Yeah, not many people can do that. Like, oh, I was in a garbage one, and now...
Completely different character, too.
Completely different, yeah. Different
Which
tone and everything.
Makes me respect him as an actor.
Yeah.
That he could play the hotshot, literally, kid, and then become the guy who's the emotional stalwart of the entire Marvel franchise.
And definitely my favorite part of Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
When he pops on, he is just my favorite part. So we were talking before just about moments in film, and then that goes towards your belief in the art that you do.
Same thing.
You know, you want to bring it into that particular moment.
Especially licensed art, and even my personal work. I believe that if this were a film, it's trying to find that right moment to encapsulate the entire scene or film or act, if you will, of the particular franchise, play, movie, whatever. That defines the film. And it might exist, it might not exist. You know, for me, like, one of my favorite paintings I've done, and it's actually one of my more successful ones, and I did it for me, was an Up piece, Pixar piece. And when I told the publisher I was doing it, they kind of was like, really? That one? It's okay. I mean, it's a good film, and nothing against the film, but commercially speaking, Up is not Cars. Up is not...
Oh, so, like, Up is good.
Well, yeah. I mean, Up is...
I think Up is amazing.
I identify with that film more than almost any other film out there, especially with Carl and Ellie in the beginning of the film.
Yes.
That speaks to me on a level that if you knew me personally, you'd know why. The film itself is a fun adventure. Adventures out there, you know. and I love that about it. And I love doing things, and I find that most of my success as a fine artist comes when I'm doing what I love to do. And we talked a little bit about painting for the money.
Yeah, yeah.
If you paint because you love it, that will show through. And so I try to do that as much as possible. And I try, and in that particular one, I did a vertical piece.
Yeah.
Going in line. It's very tall. If you go to my website, it's called Carl's Adventure. And in it, I have all the whole good guy cast, you know, from Kevin to Carl. And in the distance, you'll see Paradise Falls, and Carl has the hose going up to his house, stretches very tall. And then in the bottom is sort of a jungle, and there's paw prints to suggest the dogs are out there. And Doug is putting the tennis ball on Carl's lap, and it's all slimy, and it just and you just have that moment of like, I wanted to call the painting "Misery Loves Company," because he's literally miserable
at that
just
moment,
trying to get to where he wants to go, and he doesn't want any of these people along. And as a really big introvert, I'm like, get away from me, you know. I can understand that, you know. There's moments I just need to be away. And he's surrounded by these characters, and I just thought that was a perfect moment. And people agreed. Funny story about that piece as well. Ed Asner was in the booth next to mine at the last D23.
Oh, really?
And I had that piece out, and
just so everyone knows, Ed Asner, the voice of Carl.
Legend in TV world. He's an interesting guy. If you ever have a chance, just he's a force of nature. But people were coming over and buying my work and taking it over to him. And he would write all over the front of the art. Like, it was so nice to meet you. You and your wife are amazing. You should go dancing together. You're so great. And I love your dress. And this, I mean, it's just, this is all on the front of artwork.
Oh, my God.
And it's like a paragraph. And some people were coming back and buying another piece of my work.
Just to have a clean
and
one?
Showing me the, yeah, because it was literally three quarters full of handwriting. And I just, I love that story. And I went over and I talked to him for a while. And he thanked me for having the art there. And I'm like, thank you for selling out my painting. This is great. You should come back to the next one.
We've been here a long time. Let me just ask you one more question. And then I'll let you go. What is a Star Wars? Because we talk a lot about Star Wars. What's a Star Wars painting you haven't done yet that you want to? Is there a concept that you're trying to toy with?
I have done a few of the cantina scene, and I went back and talked a little bit before about Spielberg doing spaghetti western stuff. I look at Star Wars as a western, as a gritty, gunslinger-laden, lawless frontier, the Outer Rim. And so that seemed to me, I want to recreate like a Norman Rockwellian version of the cantina scene, and I've done probably three so far. One original that I didn't know this, but I wasn't allowed to paint the twins, the two girl twins from the cantina scene. Something with Lucasfilm and licensing. I don't know what it is.
Okay.
I was told to omit them. So I did another one for a couple commissions. People liked the piece, but I'm still trying to figure it out in my head, because to me, having that, the smugglers meet, like it's almost a little bit like the concept art for Pirates of the Caribbean, where you have the guy with the knife in the table with the candle in the middle, and they're discussing
the plunder,
where you have Obi-Wan and Luke, Chewie and Han sort of leaning in, discussing smuggling themselves off the planet, like that kind of a thing. I want to do that. It's just, it's involved. It's, you have four likenesses you have to meet. It's, and it, in the movie, you don't actually see that, all four of them together. It's sort of a back and forth dialogue shot.
Yeah, there's no wide shot of the table.
I want to make one shot.
I gotcha.
Where they're around the table with that candlelight that creates the light. Maybe a blue highlight coming from that little window they have above them. And then sort of in the distance, the whole set of the bar with the alien vampire and all that fun stuff.
So,
that
just, so yeah. nuts. So yeah. nuts. And a NASA. Yeah. And the guy in a NASA suit.
But yeah, forgive me, it's just, it's going to be time consuming. And as an artist, there's a balance, again, balance between being productive and spending a lot of time on one piece. So
yeah.
I've been putting it off and putting it off, putting it off. But if you look at my work, you'll see I did an Obi-Wan portrait.
Yes.
And that was
yes.
sort of me wanting to do that whole scene, but in one little subset.
One little piece.
So that's sort of like a, we'll call it a proof of concept.
All right. Okay. So where can everyone find you on the web now?
I'm pretty much on every social platform. Usually you'll find me under Rob Kaz Art. And my website is robkazart.com. And if you're in the Orlando area on July the 1st, I'll be here. I'll be at Comic-Con. A couple days before, I'll be at San Diego, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll also be at Comic-Con New York.
Okay.
And I've got a few shows. But again, everything will be on my website. Check me out there. It's been a lot of fun.
All
Thanks
right.
so much.
Yeah, man. That was really great.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you very
it.
Much. Rob Kaz, everyone. And there you go. That was my conversation with Rob Kaz. So, yeah. Covered a lot of ground. A lot of ground. A lot of fun ground, though. Just to reiterate, everywhere that you can find him on the social media and whatnot, on Twitter, you can find him at Rob Kaz Art. That's RobKazArt. And really, that's the path to everything, because he's Rob Kaz Art on Instagram. RobKazArt.com is his website. And on Facebook, Rob Kaz Art. Now, as we were saying before, also, he is going to be appearing at the Weiland Gallery over at the Boardwalk Hotel, I believe the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. So that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday of this week, July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And according to Facebook, his time is 6 to 10 p.m. He's going to be there to go and visit our friend and take a look at some stuff, maybe pick yourself something up. It's really gorgeous stuff. I love the style. That he has, as I said in the interview, so I won't repeat myself over and over again, as I always do. But thank you so much for checking out this episode. I think this might be the start of a new series that we might do, that I kind of have an interest in now. Finding these cats who, you know, work for Disney in different ways. And yeah, they work for Disney, and that's really interesting to me, because I think that's so sick and so phenomenal. But what are they like outside of that? Like, what's their interest beyond that? You know, like I was saying with Rob, you know, what is the guy who gets to do this also enjoy, you know, doing, and what are his thoughts on other things? So hopefully this won't be the only time we ever have something like this go on. And definitely, hopefully not the last time we have Rob on the show specifically. So until next week, guys, and next week we are going to be looking back at Sleeping Beauty, Melissa's personal favorite film, so spoilers on whether or not she thinks it still works. I think, right? Oh, God, how twisted would that be if she's like, no, it's garbage. I really wouldn't expect that, though. Right now, you are listening to The Trouble. You can find this video and more over at youtube.com/pogo, his music at soundcloud.com/pogomix, and his website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That is D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. Find us on Facebook. If you look for the Disney Magic Hour group, add yourself to that. iTunes, 5-star review. Melissa will read it for you. Obviously, she's not here right now. She's at work. So that'll be next week. And if you go over to Google Music Play, into their podcast section, search for Disney Magic Hour. And the mecca is soundcloud.com/Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And I ask one huge favor. Share the show. Share it out on your Facebook page. Tweet out about it. Tell people at work about it. Anything like that. It really, really helps. That is one of the major ways that we've had as many people discover this show as we have. So I would ask you please to continue doing that. Because we love you. I don't know where that came from. All right, guys. Say goodnight, Pete. Goodnight, Pete. Say goodnight, Pogo. We'll see you next week, guys. Bye.